Welcome to The Technology Pill, a podcast that looks at how technology is reshaping our lives every day and exploring the different ways that governments and companies use tech to increase their power. My name is Gus Hossain, and I'm the Executive Director at Privacy International. So, it's been 10 years since Edward Snowden shared with journalists information about the wrongful activities of the UK and US intelligence agencies. In this edition, we want to reflect on that moment and what followed, and we also want to look forward. I'm fortunate to be joined by two modern legends of this field. Yeah, I know, it sounds dramatic,
no,
and they
okay.
just rolled their eyes.
When it's true, it's true.
It does sound dramatic, but if there are two people I go to in order to understand surveillance law and rule of law issues, it's these two people. First, we've got Ben Wisner.
Hi, I am Ben Wisner. I am a lawyer at the American Civil Liberties Union in New York.
And Caroline Wilson-Palo.
Hi, I'm Caroline Wilson-Palo. I'm the legal director and general counsel at Privacy International.
Welcome. So apart from being good colleagues and fellow travelers, they both share two characteristics that are particularly important for the topic today. First, they both led organizational responses to the Snowden revelations. Ben is actually Ed's lawyer. Caroline led the substantive legal response for PI. So that's the first thing. Second, they're both Americans. Actually, all three of us are. So I would also be fascinating for this chat to get to what the heck is going on in America when it comes to, we'll only focus on surveillance law, but we'll get to that going forward. Ten years ago around this time, we got a call to our office, which at that point, we'd only had an office for about a year, so it was a bit of a strange thing to get a phone call. And it was a call for me to do a primetime TV interview for the premier British TV station for evening news. My son was 2 months old, and my wife and I were not sleeping, and Caroline had just joined PI like maybe a month before. She'd just been hired. And as I was preparing for this interview, for the biggest moment in modern privacy history, I got a horrible stomach flu and I had to go home. And so I threw the interview at Caroline. So for the first time ever, and I'm doing it in live recording, I'm going to say this. I'm sorry, Caroline, for having thrown you at that huge moment where we knew practically nothing about the biggest story that was going on. So thank you.
You're welcome.
So my first question is for you, actually, Caroline. What was it like to have just joined a privacy organization and to have the biggest story in the world at that moment in time as something you had to respond to?
It was pretty remarkable. So as you said, I had just joined PI and I had come from private practice, a large law firm in the U.S. So I was very used to being behind the scenes, let's say, in litigation, and that was about it. And this was my first television interview ever. and here I was, you know, having someone come to our little tiny office at the time and put a little bit of makeup on start talking. And we had maybe, I think it was perhaps 24 hours after the first document, less than that.
Yeah,
it was less than that. And I had immediately started looking because this was Prism, I think, had come out. At this point, this was one.
It was the first one, right.
First one that affected the UK.
Right.
And so I had quickly gone to read Section 702, and that was about my FISA, and that was my entire prep for this interview. Yeah. And I remember really, now in retrospect, I know I shouldn't have been focusing on this so much, but trying to say U.S. persons as to people in the rest of the world, because you know that seemed so crucial to me as an aspect of
well,
the
it's,
law,
it's,
but.
Yeah, because this is, you know, while I did have the stomach flu, I was terrified to have to give that interview because, yes, you're right. First, it was about a whistle being blown that we didn't have access to any of the documents.
Yeah.
All we had was the media coverage. Second, it was about this thing called Prism, which all of a sudden got people terribly excited because there was a slide image in the leaked documents that showed the National Security Agency and every internet company that we know. And so like, what's going on there? And then third, it involved a part of U.S. law that is so opaque. And that we'll come back to later as we talk about where's U.S. law at now. But that differentiates between Americans and non-Americans, or U.S. persons and non-U.S. persons. And so you're being asked to comment on first, like, why is Google on this slide? And then these tiny things in U.S. law that nobody else really knows much about that you had to learn right before the interview.
Right. In about 5 hours.
with quite a hostile press. I mean, one of the things that was striking about the UK media, unlike the US, was that you had one outlet, The Guardian, that was doing this courageous reporting, and then you had the government and the rest of the media beating up on The Guardian and on The Source, which is something that we did not have to deal with in the US context.
That was an extraordinary difference, and I'll get to that. But I'm curious, Ben, like, as much as you're allowed to speak about these things, like, what was the early moments for you? I guess at some point some guy just emailed you asking, will you be my lawyer?
No, not exactly. I mean, for me, it started quite a bit earlier. Although I didn't learn Snowden's name until the rest of the world did, when that remarkable video was posted on the Guardian website around the 9th of June in 2013. I knew what was going on.
My name's Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA. The NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default. It collects them in its system, and it filters them, and it analyzes them, and it measures them, and it stores them. This is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
Laura Poitras had come to my office in January of 2013, had said, could you please leave your phone in your desk and can we go and have a coffee somewhere? And she had brought with her a stack of printouts that she had received over encrypted channels from someone identifying himself as Citizen 4, who insisted that he had important information to share from within the belly of the U.S. national security establishment that would, in his view, change the world. And Laura's question for me, as someone who had advised her over the years, was, A, is this person a crank? B, am I being set up? Or C, is this possibly legitimate? The first question is important because anyone, as you know, who works in the surveillance space gets all kinds of wild intakes from people who claim to have the most important revelations in the history of the world. But the tone here was pretty restrained, although there were some grandiose words. There were no claims being made that were implausible. And my advice to Laura at the time was, go the next step, but be sure you don't do this as a solo actor. You need to link up with an institution that has a general counsel's office so that you're not exposed and so that you can't be isolated. I knew in May of 2013 that she and Glenn Greenwald were flying off to Hong Kong to meet their source. We all imagined it would be someone near the end of his career with gray hair and not someone who looked like a high school student like Snowden. So, and then in the days before the first stories were published, a few of us had seen the first documents that were going to be in those stories because there was comment in those stories from civil society. For us, the very first revelation, PRISM was second. The first was the publication of an order from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court ordering Verizon Business Records, which happened to be the ACLU's phone provider, to turn over on a daily basis all of the metadata from all of its customers' phone calls to be stored for 5 years. This was in Snowden's intention, and in fact, the ACLU's ticket to federal court. Every attempt that we had made before, including one that the Supreme Court had shut down just months earlier, to challenge intelligence surveillance programs had been tossed on secrecy and standing grounds. The government argued and the courts agreed that we could not establish that our plaintiffs had been subject to these surveillance programs because they were secret programs, and therefore neither we nor anyone else could challenge them. And so in March of 2013, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, had decided in a case called Amnesty International v. Clapper, where we were counsel, that our challenge to Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, which Caroline just mentioned and we'll come back to, could not go forward because of standing grounds. And this, Snowden has said publicly and to me, was really the final piece of his motivation. He recognized that the courts were not going to correct this. And therefore, the public needed to be invited in, and we needed the kind of evidence that court said was required so that we could bring a challenge like that.
And that was the, sorry to call it a gift, but that was the gift we've been waiting for.
Absolutely right. 2 years later, in 2015, one of the most important federal appellate courts in the United States, in a 100-page decision, ruled comprehensively that this program was illegal and had always been illegal. Mind you, this is a program that had been approved by a secret intelligence court that hears only from the government. As soon as we were able to challenge this in an adversarial process, the court reached the opposite conclusion.
It's extraordinary. Whereas in the UK, the government was always fond of saying everything that we're doing was legal until they went and wrote it down to say, yes, it's written down and legal, essentially. It's a challenge. But yeah, just to contrast the responses from the media, what I found fascinating was that up until the day that Snowden did his brave act, all the media were on our side. We had just fought a policy initiative where the intelligence agency was trying to own the internet or master the internet. And the political buy-in to our arguments was incredibly strong. Every newspaper, except for one in this country, was on our side. And it was beautiful. And we'd actually pushed it down just, this is about, say, 6 months before. But then when Snowden happened, we were expecting the same level of friendship and support. And instead, it was this us versus them, because there are two things about the British story. The British dynamic is, first, we hate whistleblowers. They're traitors. You know, that's, there's something about, you can say it's the inverse of the James Bond bit. It is the fact that the intelligence agencies in this country in the 60s and 70s and 80s did have people who defected, and that they're still scarred by this, particularly because they came from the elite from society as well. So there's a certain cultural thing. But also it's because they hate The Guardian. Right. And The Guardian had essentially run a campaign against all the other newspapers who had been breaching the privacy of celebrities and the royal family. And so The Guardian had a target on its back. And the fact it was only The Guardian talking about these stories, whereas before that day, all the other newspapers would have front page stories about surveillance, surveillance being bad. They all clammed up and just targeted The Guardian, and they hated this story.
I had lunch yesterday with Ewan McCaskill, who was one of the Guardian journalists who traveled to Hong Kong to meet Snowden and who wrote some of the important coverage. And he was recalling that time, you know, Alan Rusbridger was the editor, and he went to the BBC and said, "Do you want to see these documents? Do you want to be part of the reporting?" And they said, "Oh dear, no, oh, absolutely no, absolutely not. No, we wouldn't do that." And that may be a weakness in hindsight in the way that the story was rolled out here. One of the real benefits of the way that it was rolled out in the US is that you did not have a single news organization. Mm-hmm. And again, our environment is different. The reason why Snowden didn't want just one news organization is not because the others would team up against it, but because it was what he called a single point of failure. If the government could persuade this one entity not to publish a story, that was the end of it. Whereas if you had The Guardian and The Washington Post and then later other newspapers essentially realizing that everyone had the same material, that would inject some competition into it. So it wasn't just the White House says it's naughty to publish this and we have to decide. It was, we'll be embarrassed if the New York Times puts it on the front page after we withheld it.
Yeah. And whereas in this country, the response was that the intelligence agency showed up at the Guardian offices and took a grinder to the computers that had the data and the files on them.
One of the most incredible images I've ever seen, one of the Guardian employees surreptitiously recorded it on an iPhone. So the video of this exists, and there's no greater example of a government tantrum, given that everyone knew that the material had already been shared with the Guardian US. Yeah.
The paper, which had other copies of the Snowden files overseas, agreed to take an angle grinder to the computer while the intelligence agents watched.
So this really was just, we need to come here and break something. Now, their explanation is, we didn't trust that you could keep it secure. So even if there was another copy somewhere else, we needed to break this one. But of course, it was only the newspapers that had managed to keep it secure.
Exactly. We had a little bit of fun with that. First, the actual hardware that they destroyed, they left behind. And we arranged with one of the larger museums in this country to put it into an exhibit. And so it became a testament to this is what goes wrong when governments have too much power over the press. But we looked at what they did destroy and what they didn't destroy. And we got fascinated by the parts of the motherboards that they decided to destroy that we thought had no data on it. So we analyzed it. We wrote to, it was an Apple computer. So we wrote to Apple asking, you know, what's going on here? Why did they destroy this? It should have been off. There should be no data there. And we published the analysis on our website. Our website melted down for a few days after that. People were just so fascinated to see what were these chips and whatnot. So yeah, whatever the government did to try to clamp down, it was a bit of a, as they say in football parlance, a bit of an own goal. But at the same time, the bastards got away with it, didn't they, Caroline?
They did. And it's really interesting because you were talking about how you needed that first release, the order, to have standing in the U.S. to challenge these various government surveillance practices. But here, we actually had the ability to immediately go in court, and we actually could have even before the Snowden documents came out, because there's this court here called the Investigatory Powers Tribunal that hears challenges against the intelligence agencies. And the whole sort of reason it exists is because they recognize that you often don't know that you're under secret surveillance. And so you don't need any standing in the American sense to go into this court. You can just hypothetically suggest that there is surveillance happening to you, and the IPT has to then go and investigate. And that happens in secret and figure out what's happening and if it is in accordance with the law. So we, right away, a few days after that initial press interview, put together a complaint and submitted it to the IPT, except this time it wasn't just hypothetical. We, of course, had all these documents to back it up. And we first went in on PRISM. And it was a few weeks later, I think, that Tempora came out.
Tempora was, for us, the gold mine.
Yeah.
It was the program that was predominantly GCHQ, if I recall correctly, yeah, that was the interception of submarine cables. Mm-hmm. And so these are these huge cables that go into the water that carry data across the world. A large number of them seemed, for some reason, we all know why,
yes,
end up in jurisdictions close to the United Kingdom
or the
actual islands themselves. Yeah. And so there's a beach in Bude, which is in Cornwall, where there's a huge cable that comes in. And it just so happens some interception takes place shortly after that cable hits the beach.
They sit on the backbone of those communications networks and make a copy of everything, yes, right?
Exactly. So that's what Tempora was. This idea that they were copying everything to create a time machine. In fact, there was a great debate when we eventually did get into court. And part of why we didn't get as much satisfaction about things changing is that for the longest time, the UK government refused to confirm or deny that these documents were legitimate and any of these programs actually existed. And this led to a rather funny part when we finally appeared before the IPT in the oral arguments, where we debated, was it tempora, like time, or was it tempura, like the fried Japanese And we said, well, we think it's tempura because what they were doing was capturing at least 3 days worth of all the content that was traveling over these cables. And for 30 days, for 30 days, they were capturing all metadata that was traveling over these cables, holding on to it in case they might need it, and in many cases, just storing it all, too. So we went into court and said, that's mass surveillance. That seems to be completely against the various rights frameworks that we have here in the UK and in Europe. But unfortunately, in the end, the court in the UK, the tribunal, didn't agree with us.
Well, and in the US, I should say, I mean, this program was known as upstream surveillance, basically the same thing where the US was keeping a copy and then running thousands of search queries that were not approved by any court. And really just this year, or maybe the end of last year, I lose track of time, our legal challenge to that ended before it could even begin on the ground of state secrecy and standing, that despite the Snowden allegations, there still was not enough concrete evidence that our plaintiff in that case, which is Wikimedia, which is likely to be impacted by any mass surveillance program given its reach, we weren't able to establish to the court's satisfaction that we had standing and could go forward and could litigate the case without exposing state secrets and harming national security. So we are at the magic moment where we need another source to come forward and to refresh public knowledge here.
So you both described some dynamics that made this particularly hard to respond to at that moment. Even though it was what we were waiting for this entire time, it was hard to respond because of, you know, the Guardian dynamics or the UK government being particularly troublesome or the courts just not still willing to bite into this. If I could just add an additional dynamic, for the first time ever, my family knew what I did for a living. But I don't think they quite understood it. I remember speaking to my mom a couple of days after because she watches American news all the time. And she said, "Do you know this Ed Snowden guy?" And I said, "No, not personally." And she said, "Why is he being so mean to Obama?" And it's like, and so there was also that dynamic. And equally, though, my understanding of American political history on surveillance, because I grew up in the 1990s discourses where you had a Clinton presidency and you had Republicans who, in the Senate particularly, who were fervent believers in privacy, fervent believers in encryption. You know, John Ashcroft was responsible for some of the encryption, pro-encryption policy in the U.S. Senate, who then became Bush's attorney general post 9/11 and then completely flipped. And so I was worried we were going to face that dynamic all over again, where you had a president of one party and the other party would try to hold to account. But that didn't even happen this time around. And in the UK parliament, that didn't happen as well. Like, the opposition just did not arise at all. It was extraordinary, the political silence in the UK. And as a charity, we don't talk about political parties and we try to stay above the fray. And it's easy when the fray didn't even happen, which was very annoying. What was it like in the US?
You know, it didn't resolve into the sort of usual predictable partisan lines. With all of these kind of surveillance and privacy issues, there's the problem of abstraction and getting political traction. I think because Snowden's story was so dramatic, we had this moment where the public was paying a lot of attention. And one other thing that was a real benefit in this dynamic was that, you know, this was not one disclosure where the intelligence community could then get their act together, get their story straight, admit what they needed to admit, deny everything else, and move on. They had no idea what was going to be published the next week, the week after that, the week after that, the week after that. So they were really on their heels for months, and the momentum sort of kept driving forward one story after another. One divide that was interesting is that you had the technology community in Silicon Valley and elsewhere outraged by the disclosures. People who were not necessarily traditional Democrats or Republicans, but very wealthy and very influential, who were learning that, in the words of some of them, the NSA was setting fire to the internet, that even as they were coming in the front door with court orders, they were breaking into the back door at places where communications were not encrypted. And so you had this whole influential community sort of waking up to a different threat model and people who had political influence. And, you know, when we finally did have legislation in the U.S. in 2015, it was bipartisan and it passed. You know, Obama, after initially saying nothing to see here, don't worry about it, appointed a high-level presidential panel that included senior intelligence officials and legal experts, and they recommended a series of really sweeping changes. So there really was, for this moment, some energetic oversight. I mentioned before the courts, I just said Congress. You saw the media getting much more aggressive in response to the usual government tactics, telling them you're going to have blood on your hands. And then you had the technology community creating another kind of check and balance and hardening their encryption. The director of national intelligence lamented in an interview that the Snowden disclosures had accelerated the adoption of encryption by 7 years, yeah. Which Snowden says is the nicest thing anyone has ever said about him. Right. Yep. So I think that, you know, had there been a Republican president at the time, you might have seen what you had with the war on terror dynamics earlier, where there was all this horror on the liberal side at the abuses. And that was not the case. Yeah. But in a way, the kind of debate that took place might have been more honest as a result of that.
Yeah. So the first time I met Ed, I was speechless, partly because, like, I've seen this guy so many times and here I am able to talk with him. But second, I was ashamed because, like, here's this guy who did this extraordinary sacrifice so that we could all know this story. And he basically said to the journalists, like, run with it. And I felt like he was saying that to us, though he never said that to us, which was like, now do what you do. And that was an incredible amount of responsibility, not just because we're taking on intelligence agencies, but this guy sacrificed so much for this to happen. And I feel guilt every day about, you know, did we do good by this brave act, by this brave individual who wanted the world to be better as a result of that? Caroline, going to you first, was there a moment where you felt like, okay, you know what? We've accomplished something as a result of this. We can sleep better at night knowing that we've done something and left a mark with what he sacrificed.
Well, I think in many ways, we're some of the few who were in the UK. You've just described those dynamics of how all these different institutions and the press got involved in the US in this debate. And as you said here, you know, Parliament sort of stepped back. There were a few committees formed. There was a little bit of additional oversight. They published a few reports. So we ended up ultimately with legislation that in many ways enshrined a lot of these powers into law here and allowed them to continue with a few safeguards. But the people who were really pushing for additional reform were civil society. And the only way we were able to do it was through this litigation pathway that we had. And it wasn't just us. It was a variety of other organizations within the UK, too. But we ended up leading a lot of that litigation. And that has led to a number of court judgments that have done what as much as we can do so far to actually sort of increase the level of oversight and increase the number of safeguards around bulk surveillance. They haven't gotten rid of mass surveillance. They haven't gotten rid of the power. It's still here in the UK, and we still see that as problematic, but at least we did a lot to rein it in. And we got important judgments at the European Court of Human Rights, the Court of Justice of the European Union in the course of doing that, which affect not just the UK, but a whole host of...
Exactly. For the non-Europeans listening, you know, in the US, you can take a case to the Supreme Court and it affects... arguably what happens in America, but we had the fortune of being able to take cases beyond the UK courts into the court of the European Union. Their judgments have sway across all the EU member states, but also the European Court of Human Rights, which is a body that has 55 member states now that Russia has been thrown out. But up until then, our court decisions, our wins there would influence what an intelligence agency in France would be able to do going forward. So that, yeah, I definitely slept better after you got that all the way up there and got the results we were to some degree hoping for. Ben, you were a little bit closer, of course, and I'm not sure there was ever a valedictory moment, was there?
Well, there was the first one, the moment that gave me goosebumps. You know, I mentioned that we went into court right away with this ticket that Snowden had given us. Within a week, we had challenged this mass metadata collection program, the phone records program. We weren't the only ones who challenged that. And in another parallel lawsuit that was actually filed by a conservative lawyer, a Republican right-wing federal judge in Washington, D.C., in December of 2013, ruled that this program was unconstitutional and described it as almost Orwellian.
Nice.
And this was so... unprecedented for us to get a ruling on the merits, to have it go against the NSA. And then a few weeks later, the New York Times, the most important newspaper in the world that had been initially excluded from being part of the coverage, published a unsigned editorial, Edward Snowden whistleblower, and called for him to get clemency. And remember, this is that we have the whole machinery of the defense and intelligence community trying to paint him as irresponsible, immature, a narcissist, a traitor. And for these organs of the establishment to come out and say, no, 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 actually what he exposed was illegal. Actually, he did a public service. And we need to stop talking about him in this framework of, you know, criminal, traitor, or otherwise. It was an amazing moment for all of us and for me personally.
I'm still waiting for my mom to acknowledge that. But, you know, that is incredibly impressive. And so all these years later, can you say, beyond necessarily the surveillance aspects, is there a positive legacy that he may feel he can look and say, you know what, I've done something there. It might not be a change in a law. Like, is it possible that he's forged a path for the next whistleblower or?
Well, I think we have seen a lot more whistleblowing since then. Maybe not enough, and maybe not enough from positions like his. But these kind of mass leaks like the Panama and Paradise Papers, and you're now seeing a lot of people from inside big tech coming forward with important information. Again, I mentioned before, I think a new attitude of the media, at least in the US, that we're going to be respectful, but we're going to be less intimidated by national security claims. One remarkable thing about the Snowden disclosures is that 10 years later, we have not yet seen a persuasive account of the putative harm that these disclosures caused.
Excellent.
There's never been a document that's been produced by the US government saying, here's the way we were harmed by this. No plausible account has been made. I think that the changes that, again, Snowden is most proud of are that, you know, in 2013, encryption was kind of exotic. It was geeks and nerds who were using PGP for encrypted email. And now we have these billions of people using WhatsApp or Signal or end-to-end encrypted devices. So much of the traffic that goes across the internet now is encrypted when before it was not. And again, this doesn't make surveillance impossible. It just makes it costlier. It adds friction and makes the government be more selective in cases about what it wants to see and read. And look, we didn't get all the legal reforms that we wanted, not even close. But we did get the most significant legal reform since the 1970s to intelligence surveillance in the U.S. So we did get courts into the game. We did get Congress to restrict rather than expand the surveillance authority of the U.S. government. And we may return to this in a little while, but 10 years beyond Snowden, this year we're having a very consequential debate about whether this important surveillance provision, Section 702, which was the putative legal authority for the prison program and for upstream surveillance in the U.S., should be reauthorized in its current form. And there does seem to be a strong bipartisan coalition in Congress to put new restraints on that. I think no whistleblower quite achieves the reforms that they imagine. Snowden's no exception. But I do also want to return to his original motivation, which had as much at least to do with democratic participation as it had to do with surveillance reform. And in almost all of our democracies, we had a different kind of debate, even if it didn't resolve the way that privacy advocates might have preferred.
Absolutely. I mean, and we had that ostensibly here as well. I've already criticized the Investigatory Powers Act of 2016, which was the legislative change in the United Kingdom after, and also subsequent parliamentary committees that sort of revealed a bit more about the surveillance powers that we hadn't known prior to Snowden. And while generally, I think that it added a handful of safeguards, but mostly just sanctioned mass surveillance, we're able to have that democratic debate, which we couldn't have before. And we've seen this again and again in our lawsuits where the UK says, well, actually, we did have this power, because it's part of what they have to argue when they're trying to defend themselves in the lawsuits. They have to say that they are acting in accordance with law, and that means that there has to be some publicly accessible law out there that governed the surveillance operations they were undertaking. And they point to these obscure provisions that maybe two people, including some of our friends prior to the Snowden documents, read as actually authorizing this level of mass surveillance. And they say, but actually it was there. Where, again, in some of these reports that came out after the Snowden documents here, they did emphasize that there was a loss of trust and that even the parliamentarians didn't realize that these provisions that they'd authorized were going to be used in the way that they were being used.
And that's absolutely beautiful. Absolutely.
Yeah. So then we got the IPA, and there was a debate around it, and we did get a few improvements. Maybe the most significant is that in the UK before this, you had the branch of government, the executive, that was engaging in surveillance, also authorizing the surveillance. There was no independent judge, like in the US, that was signing off on the warrant to say this would go forward. We now have an independent system of judicial commissioners that sign off on warrants, which was pretty significant for the UK.
So the introduction of judicial warrants,
Huge
development that we'd been banging on about for at least 15 years that I'd been working on surveillance law in this country. It happened in 2016. And I want to say there's a very tight line between Snowden and that, but nobody will ever admit that. But also the other thing, despite being the land of the Magna Carta, the amount of so-called law that's not actually written down on a piece of paper is ridiculous. And I think that's one thing that we have changed in this country, that there's no longer enough for the government to say, oh, there's a law. Where is it? Show it to us. And in one case, and I'm surprised Caroline didn't talk about this case, but maybe because it would make her swear and she's too professional. One day in court, they were asked, you know, what is this law? And then the next day in court, they showed up having typed it overnight and presented to the judges the next day saying, here it is.
Oh, that didn't just happen once. That was in every single case that we filed because they didn't have enough clarity in these sort of very broad provisions, some dating from the early 80s that they were using to engage in this surveillance.
It's a special common law oral tradition.
Exactly.
Making it up as we go along.
So it's become a bit of a joke.
But we've actually forced the government to send intelligence agents to court to give evidence.
No.
That was never done before either. So, significant transformation in the way that accountability is done. Let's move forward. Last week, I was reading the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg how China might be setting up a listening base in Cuba and the level of outrage that was going on about a listening base in Cuba, listening into And then it occurred to me, what exactly is a listening base listening into anymore? It may be in the 1960s, that might have been interesting. But now, because, well, submarine cables, but also encryption and other forms of communication, it's not exactly clear if old school ways of doing things still apply because of what happened with Snowden. But also, I think that might introduce a different dynamic in our surveillance debates now with the rise of China, the concern about Russia, and whether it's interference or just general surveillance, or the existence of spyware from various jurisdictions, including companies in some jurisdictions, that has transformed the threat. So I'm curious, Ben, what is the politics looking like in the U.S.?
Well, there's other dynamics in the U.S. I think the TikTok ban and the whole debate about banning TikTok is very funny. Among other things, it's clearly not constitutional under our First Amendment. But, you know, the idea, mon Dieu, the Chinese are in our apps, like the Russians were in our Facebook. And, you know, going back to 2013, of course, the argument was, it doesn't matter if it's foreign surveillance. We should only be worried about surveillance by one's own government, because that's the only one that has any kind of coercive authority.
And you owned the internet. You as an America owned the internet in 2013.
I mean, I think actually probably what's driving the debate in the U.S. on the Republican side now is less panic about China than it is reaction to the investigation of Trump during the Russia investigation. And actually, some significant surveillance abuses from that investigation have been revealed by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice. Some of the FISA warrants were obtained through FBI sort of falsification in warrant requests, leaving out key information. And it has sort of shined a spotlight on how easy it is for the U.S. government, under the guise of programs that are targeted at non-Americans, to sweep up the communications of millions of Americans. This has always been true. It's the drum that we've been beating on for a long time. But what the U.S. government does is it says, we're not targeting Americans. We're targeting the communications of foreigners. Those communications are often with Americans. We're collecting them lawfully by targeting foreigners. But oh, now we have these communications. Why shouldn't we be able to look at them? They were collected lawfully. It's a kind of bait and switch that they use. And our argument has been, if you're sitting on millions and millions of communications of Americans that you weren't able to target, then you should have to get judicial permission to look at them. You shouldn't be able to just hand them off to not even intelligence investigators, law enforcement, this information that was collected without any kind of suspicion whatsoever. And so that would be the most significant reform. The sort of technical term for this is backdoor searches, because it's information that they just happen to stumble on. You know, of course, the whole point of this program is to collect communications involving Americans, because if it was collections between foreigners speaking to foreigners, you wouldn't even need this authority in the first place. But yeah, I do think that what's driving it more, and what's driving many Republicans, for better and for worse, into this debate, is this sense that the intelligence community abused its authority in a political investigation of Trump, and now we need safeguards. You know, I think there is actually some validity to that view. I question whether many of these members of Congress would be interested had there not been this kind of partisan valence. And so I don't think these are long-term allies of the civil liberties community. But if they want to join forces, we will never have 51% of the public agreeing with the American Civil Liberties Union. We're going to need people for their own reasons and their own goals to align with us on these issues. I think we have a fighting chance this time.
That's extraordinary. Whereas the situation in the UK, and this is just my take, I'm not saying this is PI's take, but the UK's global political power relies so much on its relationship with the US. And a lot of its relationship with the US is based on its intelligence power. It's kind of like within this game, Israel's power comes from intelligence agencies producing so many intelligence agents who then go off into the private sector and start up hacking companies. In Britain, it's just the power and the reach of the intelligence agency. And for that to ever be called into question, it's just so hard at a political level. But I think the rise of China is like all of a sudden British political leaders aren't just thinking about tapping the rest of the world's communications. They're now waking up and realizing, oh, we're a little bit vulnerable now. Now to the point where it gets ridiculous, like the Huawei scare in this country was just absurd. But you know, they had to do something, and so they banned the technology, and America's followed relative suit on that. Well, actually, I don't know.
So an interesting dynamic that we have here, and then I'll let Caroline speak, is on the encryption debate, there's huge parts of the intelligence community that actually agree with civil society, that defense is more important than offense, that protecting our networks is more important than attacking theirs. In their simple terms, our stuff is more valuable than the Chinese stuff. It's more important that we protect our stuff than that we have their stuff. And then the added dynamic is that when these people leave the NSA and the CIA, they are swept up at $1 million a month by contractors who are being paid by the technology companies. And so you have the former heads of Department of Homeland Security of the NSA now on the pro-encryption side of the debate, while it's the law enforcement side. And, you know, they'll say, look, if I were the director of the FBI, I would want to break encryption too, but we have other values involved. And I think the reason why we've been so successful until now in not having mandatory, legally mandated backdoors into encryption is precisely because you have significant parts of the sort of cyber defense establishment who say, it's not worth it. You got plenty of surveillance tools. You're going to be fine. Don't weaken our defenses against vexatious hackers and foreign states.
We've had the same debate here. And we have, actually, within GCHQ, there's a separate section of GCHQ that's in charge of security here within the UK, and they very much have been pushing, in their case, to come up with a mechanism to try to get at those encrypted communications they want without breaking encryption. And there's, of course, a huge technical debate around whether or not that can actually be accomplished. But I think I completely agree with you in that regard, too. I think one thing, though, going back to encryption being such an important development post-Snowden, is that what we have seen the debate also move from the content of communications to much more the communications data. And as you said, Gus, the UK really sees itself as the place, and this comes out in the documents too, where they can capture a lot of surveillance in part because the legal regime here, this is very explicitly said. And one of the aspects of legal regime up until relatively recently was that communications data had much lower protections than content, because it was seen as being not as intrusive.
Which is funny because it's so much more valuable to intelligence agencies.
Exactly. And now it is the thing they need right. with encryption. It is the most important because the communications data is not encrypted. So that is what they want. And we have had success again at two European courts that I talked about in both raising the standard of protection for communications data to the same level as content, because the courts now realize that it is as important. But that was another significant change.
It's more revealing. Content can lie, metadata can't.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's draw this to a close with a slight dark and then move to the light. I'm married to a Greek, and there was recently elections in Greece where the prime minister, who had recently been caught spying using spyware on his colleagues in cabinet and opposition members, got reelected, or essentially did not get punished at the ballot as a result of this and a number of other cases of corruption and wrongdoing. And my wife shared with me an article where a journalist wrote up saying, well, this is just proof that, you know, things are so bad because nobody cares. Clearly, the Greek people should have thrown this guy out because of the abuses, particularly of the spyware abuses. And so everything's lost. Now, I've been working in this field for 26 years, and I'll admit I've gone through ebbs and flows, but I'm actually feeling incredibly optimistic in this moment in time. I feel like we've never had this level of awareness. And you know, we had Edward Snowden in 2013 finally show the world what we were saying was potentially possible was possible. And there was even like a movie or three about it, and there were awards, and everybody was talking about these things, and we got legislative changes and whatnot. But things are a little shit right now, too. So what, after having been through these 10 years, and I know you both had longer careers than that on these issues, but I'm still curious, with this 10-year period, with its ups and downs, how are you feeling about where we're heading next?
Well, on mass surveillance, it's really quite interesting because for a long time, we've tried to capture the public imagination, as you were just talking about with the spyware, too. Spyware seems to be much easier in that regard. You can really think about someone hacking your phone and seeing your private messages. With mass surveillance, it's tapping into these giant cables going across the ocean that seemed much more abstract. And so a good part of the last 10 years, we tried to figure out how to engage the public on this. And I am hopeful that that is changing a bit. For instance, the use of facial recognition technology, which has suddenly become so prominent and in the news and is being challenged in local communities across the U.S., for instance, in the U.K. too. And they're saying, no, we don't want to use this. That is a form of mass surveillance, of course, is, you know, scanning everyone's faces in the same way that you'd scan everyone's communications if you're looking for someone that might be a suspect. And I think that we are seeing people stepping up and actually being more aware that this is out there. And this is creeping closer and closer to some of those other countries like Russia and China that have problematic surveillance regimes. And that's what we don't want. And then also in the UK, we did have some successes. We do have better oversight regimes now. We do have better mechanisms. And we even forced some of those mechanisms, like the IPT, to be more public, to say more about what surveillance is happening, to say more about the errors. We just recently, early this year, got a judgment out of the IPT criticizing MI5 for the internal failure to not follow the safeguards that the Investigatory Powers Act had imposed. And I think that would, again, be almost unimaginable 10 years ago, to have that insight into what was happening internally within one of the spy agencies. So there is reason for hope.
You see, I think the Greek example that you gave is kind of dark evidence about how tribal politics have become in most of our countries, and that people stop evaluating their tribe based on things that did or didn't happen and just accept anything that we do against the other side that needs to be done. And I think for the most part, surveillance and privacy issues have been kept outside of that and need to stay outside of that, that people kind of need to understand that whatever it is that you allow your side to do is going to be done by the other side. And it's why, I mean, I think historically and still somewhat now, these issues have been pretty nonpartisan in the U.S. context. You have had conservative libertarians, and I know you have it here as well, who have been raising the alarm when we look at sort of state legislation that puts restrictions on law enforcement. You see these laws passing first in Utah and Montana before they're passed in Massachusetts or California. For your UK listeners, Utah and Montana are very conservative states. And I think that even in our courts, at least in the law enforcement context where we can litigate, right, intelligence, the problem is secrecy. It's still secrecy. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of bipartisan concern. We've seen a bunch of landmark decisions from our very conservative Supreme Court acknowledging that the digital age is making surveillance much cheaper and easier for the government, and we need new constitutional bulwarks to add friction where we didn't need it before, that law enforcement needs to get a warrant from a judge before they can call Verizon and get all the location records from my phone. These are things that I don't know that we would have had the same kind of developments in the law in a bipartisan way had Snowden not massively increased and a public awareness that these devices can be used against us and not just for us. And so I think that is what makes me cautiously optimistic still, is that we can address different audiences here that have different concerns. What makes me nervous is just that, you know, when you now see Trump critics valorizing law enforcement and the intelligence community because Trump has attacked them, I worry that we're now going to have Democrats being the party of enforcing classification, defending the FBI, and not raising important concerns about their power and their reach.
Yeah, I count my lucky stars every day I get to work in this field. And I think back to when, before I started work on privacy issues, there was always a temptation to be, if you're interested in these issues, to become essentially a political hack. And I wanted to work on the larger frame. I wanted to work on these things like rule of law, constitutionality, checks and balances. And I thought, where do I get to work on those things? Little did I know that privacy and surveillance, we navigate this stuff every single day. And just going back to some of the cases that Caroline's led on, we have substantively made the rule of law a little bit clearer. That is something that teenage version of me would have never believed I'd have the fortune to be working in a field like that. And so you read the news every day, and so you hear the outrage about the China base in Cuba. We have an understanding of what's going on there as a result. You hear about anything going on in the world, you can see this stuff matters. And if you don't get dug in to the tribalism and the politics, it's actually the most wonderful place to work. So thank you very much. Thank you for the last 10 years of what you've done on this. And Ben, please just send our best to Ed. What he did just made so much possible.
I'll be very sure he listens to this podcast.
That's very kind. Thank you for listening. Remember, you can tell us what you think about the podcast by visiting us at pvcy.org/tpsurvey. You can sign up to be the first to learn more about our work at pvcy.org/podsignup. And we'll include some links to relevant articles and information in the description or on our website at pvcy.org/techpill. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the podcast in whichever platform you use. Music is courtesy of Sepia. This podcast was produced by Max Burnell for Privacy International.